Epilogue. A last gasp. Nothing about this place has changed. The threadbare Persian rug, the paint-chipped window that rattles in the breeze, the rumble of diesel trucks chugging up Page Street. A few of the faces are the same, too. There's the guy with prisoner eyes, the other with Jerry Lewis bangs, and the blonde woman with that strange European accent. I find my usual spot in the corner and take a seat. It's been years since I first came to this room and felt the possibilities of breathing. A decade of traveling, research, and self-experimentation. In that time, I've learned that the benefits of breathing are vast, but they're also limited. This became disturbingly clear several months ago. I was in Portland, Oregon, and had just finished a lecture based on the contents of this book. I left the podium and walked to the lobby. A woman approached. Her eyes were wide, fingers jittery. She told me how her mother had just suffered a pulmonary embolism and was desperately in need of a breathing technique to remove blood clots from her lungs. A few weeks later, a woman seated next to me on a flight noticed photographs of skulls on my laptop. She asked me what I was working on. After I told her, she explained how her friend was suffering from a serious eating disorder, osteoporosis, and even cancer. No treatments had worked. She asked if I could please prescribe a breathing practice to bring her friend back to health. What I explained to each of these people, and what I'd like to make very clear right now, is that breathing, like any other therapy or medication, can't do everything. Breathing fast, slow, or not at all can't make an embolism go away. Breathing through the nose with a big exhale can't reverse the onset of neuromuscular genetic diseases. No breathing can heal stage 4 cancer. These serious problems require urgent medical attention. I wouldn't be alive without antibiotics, immunizations, and that last-minute rush to the doctor's office to zap out a lymph node infection. The medical technologies developed over the last century have increased the quality of life many times over. But modern medicine still has its own limitations. "I'm dealing with the walking dead," said Dr. Michael Gelb, who'd spent 30 years working as a dental surgeon and sleep specialist. He'd echoed what I'd heard from Dr. Don Story, my father-in-law, who'd worked as a pulmonologist for the past 40 years. Dozens of doctors at Harvard, Stanford, and other institutions told me the same thing. Modern medicine, they said, was amazingly efficient at cutting out and stitching up parts of the body in emergencies. But it was sadly deficient at treating milder chronic problems, all the asthma, stress, and autoimmune issues that most of us contend with. These doctors explained, in so many words and in so many ways, that a middle-aged man complaining of work stress, depression, and occasional tingling in his fingers wasn't going to get the same attention as a patient with kidney failure. He'd be prescribed a blood pressure medication and an antidepressant and sent on his way. The role of the modern doctor was to put out fires, not blow away smoke. Nobody was happy with this arrangement. Doctors were frustrated that they had neither the time nor the support to prevent and treat milder illnesses, while patients were learning that their cases weren't dire enough for the attention they sought. This is one of the reasons I believe so many people and so many medical researchers have come back to breathing. Like all Eastern medicines, breathing techniques are best suited as a preventative maintenance, as a way to retain the balance in the body so that smaller problems don't blossom into more serious illnesses. Should we lose the balance from time to time, breathing can often bring it back. Nobel laureate Albert Svante Gyorgy said it best. "More than 60 years of research on living systems has convinced me that our body is much more nearly perfect than the endless list of ailments suggests. Its shortcomings are due less to its inborn imperfections than to our abusing it." Svante Gyorgy was talking about the illnesses of our own making, also known as diseases of civilization. 9 out of 10 of the top killers, such as diabetes, heart disease, and stroke, are caused by the foods we eat, the water we drink, and the houses we live in. These are diseases humanity created. While some of us may be genetically predisposed towards one disease or another, that doesn't mean we're doomed to get these conditions. Genes can be turned off just as they can be turned on. What switches them are inputs in the environment. Improving diet and exercise, removing toxins and stressors, all these things have a profound and lasting effect on the prevention and treatment of chronic disease. Breathing is a key input. From what I've learned in the past decade, that 30 pounds of air that passes through our lungs every day and that 1.7 pounds of oxygen our cells consume is as important as what we eat or how much we exercise. Breathing is a missing pillar of health. If I had to limit my advice on healthier living to just one tip, it would be simply to learn how to breathe better, wrote Andrew Weil, the famed doctor. Though researchers still have much to learn about this endlessly expansive field, there is plenty of consensus right now on what breathing better looks like. In a nutshell, this is what we've learned. Step 1. Shut your mouth. 2 months after the Stanford experiment ended, Dr. Nayak's lab emailed Anders Olson and me with the results of the study. The major takeaway, we already knew. Mouth breathing is terrible. After just 240 hours of breathing only through our mouths, catecholamines and stress hormones spiked. A bacterial bug had infested my nose. If I'd continued breathing only through my mouth for a few more days, it might have developed into a full-fledged sinus infection. All the while, my blood pressure was through the roof and my heart rate variability plummeted. Olson's data mirrored mine. By night, we snored. A few days later, we started choking on ourselves, suffering from bouts of sleep apnea. Had we continued with all this, there's a decent chance we both would have developed chronic snoring and obstructive sleep apnea, along with the hypertension and metabolic problems that often come with it. Not all of our measurements changed. Blood sugar levels weren't affected. Cell counts and other stuff like ionized calcium remained the same, as did most of our other blood markers. There were a few surprises. I lost 2 pounds, due most likely to exhaled water loss. But trust me on this, a post-holiday mouth-breathing diet is not recommended. The nagging fatigue, the irritation, testiness, and anxiety, the horrid breath and constant bathroom breaks, the spaciness, stares, and stomach aches, it was awful. Our bodies have evolved to be able to breathe through two channels for a reason. It increases our chances of survival. Should the nose get plugged, the mouth becomes a backup ventilation system. The few gasping breaths Stephen Curry takes before dunking a basketball, or a sick kid huffs when he has a fever, or when you're laughing with your friends, these will have no long-term effects on your health. Chronic mouth breathing is different. The body is not designed to process raw air for hours at a time, day or night. There's nothing normal about it. Step 2. Breathe through your nose. The day Olson and I removed the plugs and tape, our blood pressure dropped, carbon dioxide levels rose, and heart rates normalized. Snoring decreased 30-fold, from several hours a night to just a few minutes. Within 2 days, neither of us were snoring at all, and the bacterial infection in my nose quickly cleared up without treatment. Ann Kearney at the Stanford Voice and Swallowing Center was so impressed by our data and her own transformation nasal breathing that at this recording she's putting together a 2-year study with hundreds of subjects to research the effect of sleep tape on snoring and sleep apnea. The benefits of nasal breathing extend beyond the bedroom. I increased my performance on the stationary bike by about 10%. Olson had more modest gains of about 5. These results paled in comparison to the gains reported by sports training expert John Dulyar, but I couldn't imagine any athlete who wouldn't want a 10% or even a 1% advantage over a competitor. On a more personal note, those first few nasal breaths after 10 days of obstruction were so shimmering and rousing that I got a little teary-eyed. I thought about my interviews with all the empty nose syndrome sufferers who'd been told that they were crazy, that they should just quit complaining and breathe through their mouths. I thought about the kids who'd been told that their chronic allergies and congestion were part of childhood, and the adults who'd convinced themselves that choking every night was a natural part of growing old. I had felt their pain and was lucky enough to breathe life on the other side. It's something I'll never forget and something I'll never, ever repeat. Step 3. Exhale. Carl Stau spent a half century reminding his students of how to get all the air out of their bodies so that they could get more in. He trained his clients to exhale longer and in the process do what had long been considered biologically impossible. Emphysemics reported almost total recovery from their incurable conditions. Opera singers gained more resonance and tone in their voices. Asthmatics no longer suffered from attacks, and Olympic sprinters went on to win gold medals. As basic as this sounds, full exhalations are seldom practiced. Most of us engage only a small fraction of our total lung capacity with each breath, requiring us to do more and get less. One of the first stages in healthy breathing is to extend these breaths, to move the diaphragm up and down a bit more, and get air out of us before taking new air in. Carl Stau wrote in the 1960s, "The difference in breathing in the coordinated pattern and in an altered pattern is the difference between operating at peak efficiency and just getting along. An engine does not have to be in tip-top condition to work, but it gives a better performance if it is." Step 4. Chew. The millions of ancient skeletons in the Paris quarries and the hundreds of pre-industrial skulls at the Morton Collection had three things in common: huge sinus cavities, strong jaws, and straight teeth. Almost all humans born before 300 years ago shared these traits because they chewed a lot. The bones in the human face don't stop growing in our 20s, unlike other bones in the body. They can expand and remodel into our 70s and likely beyond, which means we can influence the size and shape of our mouths and improve our ability to breathe at any age. To do this, don't follow the diet advice of eating what our great-grandmothers ate. Too much of that stuff was already soft and overly processed. Your diet should consist of the rougher, rawer, and heartier foods our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers ate. The kinds of foods that required an hour or two a day of hard chewing. And in the meantime, lips together, teeth slightly touching, and tongue on the roof of the mouth. Step 4. Breathe more on occasion. Since meeting Chuck McGee at the roadside park in the Sierras, I've been practicing TUMO with dozens of others from around the world on Monday nights. That's when McGee hosts a free online session open to anyone who wants to become the eye of the storm. Overbreathing has gotten a bad rap in the past few decades, and rightfully so. Feeding the body more air than it needs is damaging for the lungs, right down to the cellular level. Today, the majority of us breathe more than we should, without ever realizing it. Willing yourself to breathe heavily for a short, intense time, however, can be profoundly therapeutic. McGee told me, "It's only through disruption that we can be normal again." That's what techniques like TUMO, Sudarshan Kriya, Wim Hof breathing methods, and vigorous pranayamas do. They stress the body on purpose, snapping it out of its funk so that it can properly function for the other 23 and a half hours a day. Conscious breathing teaches us to be the pilots of our bodies, not the passengers. Step 5. Hold your breath. Several months after experimenting with CO2 therapy, I was at home reading the Sunday paper, flipping through the obituaries, when I saw that Dr. Donald Klein had died. Klein was the psychiatrist who spent years studying the links between chemoreceptor flexibility, carbon dioxide, and anxieties. He was 90 years old. It was Klein's research that inspired Justin Feinstein to pursue the NIH experiments in Tulsa. I wrote Feinstein with the news. He was crushed. He told me he'd been planning on reaching out to Klein in the coming weeks regarding what could be a, quote, game-changing discovery. It turns out that the amygdalae, those gooey nodes on the sides of our head that help govern perceptions of fear, also control aspects of our breathing. Patients with epilepsy who have had these areas stimulated with electrodes immediately ceased breathing. The patients were totally unaware of it and didn't seem to feel that CO2 rising in their bloodstreams. Communication between the chemoreceptors and the amygdalae work both ways. These structures are constantly exchanging information and adjusting breathing every second of every minute of every day. If communication breaks down, havoc ensues. Feinstein believes that people with anxieties likely suffer from connection problems between these areas and could unwittingly be holding their breath. Only when the body becomes so overwhelmed with CO2 would their chemoreceptors kick in and trigger a panic signal to the brain. The patients would start fighting to breathe. They'd get anxious. They'd have a panic attack. Eventually, their bodies adapt to avoid this panic, and they start over-breathing in an effort to keep their carbon dioxide as low as possible. Feinstein wrote, "What anxious people could be experiencing is a completely natural reaction. They're reacting to an emergency in their bodies. It could be that anxiety, at its root, isn't a psychological problem at all." This approach is all very theoretical and needs to be rigorously tested, Feinstein admitted. That's what he's going to be doing in the coming years. But if it's true, it could explain why so many drugs don't work for panic and other fear-based conditions, and how slow and steady breathing does. Step 6. How we breathe matters. I've chatted with Anders Olson every few weeks since we paid through the nose in the Stanford experiment. Our talks are never dull. "I have more energy and focus than ever in my life," he told me right after celebrating his 50th birthday. Olson is the purest kind of pulmonaut, self-taught and driven by a sense that we are missing something right in front of us, a truth both basic and essential. Through all my travels and travails, there is one lesson, one equation that I believe is at the root of so much health, happiness, and longevity. I'm a bit embarrassed to say it has taken me a decade to figure this all out, and I realize how insignificant it might sound to you right now. But lest we forget, nature is simple but subtle. The perfect breath is this. Breathe in for 5.5 seconds, then exhale for 5.5 seconds. That's 5.5 breaths a minute for a total of about 5.5 liters of air. You can practice this perfect breathing for a few minutes or a few hours. There's no such thing as having too much peak efficiency. Olson told me he's working on several more devices to help us breathe at this rate, slowly and less. He's finishing production on a portable machine that measures nitric oxide, CO2, ammonia, and other chemicals in exhaled breath. Then there are other skunkworks to mimic the effects of perfect breathing. A carbon dioxide suit, a hat, and... Meanwhile, Google has just released an app that pops up automatically when the words breathing exercise are searched. It trains visitors to inhale and exhale every 5.5 seconds. Down the street from my house is a startup called Spire, which created a device that tracks breath rate and alerts users every time respiration becomes too fast or disjointed. In the fitness industry, resistance masks and mouthpieces like Expandalung are all the rage. Before we know it, breathing slow less and through the nose will be a big business like so much else. But be aware that the stripped-down approach is as good as any. It requires no batteries, no Wi-Fi, no headgear or smartphones. It costs nothing, takes little time and effort, and you can do it wherever you are, whenever you need. It's a function our distant ancestors practiced since they crawled out of the sludge 2.5 billion years ago, A technology our own species has been perfecting with only our lips, noses, and lungs for eons. Most days, I treat it like a stretch, something I do after a long time sitting or stressing to bring myself back to normal. When I need an extra boost, I come here to this old Victorian house in the Haight-Ashbury and sit beside the rattling window with the other Sudarshan Kriya breathers I first met 10 years ago. The room is packed now, 20 of us sitting in a circle, unkinking our necks and pulling blankets onto our laps. The instructor hits the switch on the wall, the lights dim and long shadows from the street cast across the floor. In the darkness, he thanks us for coming, brushes his bangs aside, adjusts the old boombox, and presses play. We take the first breath in, then the second. The wave comes, washes over, and runs up, then turns around and recedes back to the ocean.